Welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Sally Higginbottom, and today I am interviewing Dr. Barbara Noble, a GP based in Wolverhampton. Hello.
Oh, hi, Sally.
So today we're discussing the new NICE guidance on rheumatoid arthritis, which was published last year in 2018. So let's go back to the beginning. Who gets rheumatoid arthritis?
Any age can get it, which rather surprised me. Women more than men tend to get it.
Now, that is interesting because I always think of it as something with an onset in young adult life.
That was one thing that really did surprise me about it. And it's made me rethink about what I do, actually, because you might see an older person with arthritic changes and you immediately think it's OA. And it's made me a bit more aware that it might not be.
Indeed. So don't forget, it could be rheumatoid. And so when we see someone with a new onset of swollen, painful joints, where do we start with investigations?
Well, usually most of us would do blood tests. NICE recommend that you do a rheumatoid factor. And I would usually do an NHB, ESR, CRP. They also suggest doing x-rays, especially do an x-ray of the hands, because the changes can be quite typical.
It's erosions that they're looking for, is that right?
Yeah. You can often see soft tissue swelling as well.
And so clearly anyone who you think might have rheumatoid arthritis will need referral. Locally, we have a rapid referral clinic where people are seen within a couple of weeks. Is that fairly standard nationally, do you think?
Yes, we have the same in Wolverhampton, that they will see people quite quickly. They like you to have done some bloods in the first place. And not necessarily x-rays, but positive bloods, raised ESR, raised CRP, they will see quickly.
Who do NICE say need urgent referral?
Anybody who's got involvement in the small joints of the hand, anybody who's got more than one joint affected, those who there's already maybe been a delay of about 3 months before the onset of symptoms and referral, they should be referred urgently.
So where there's been a delay between the symptoms developing and the patient seeing us, that's another indication, because the aim is to get on to effective treatment as soon as possible.
Yes, to stop any damage being done.
My understanding now is that the aim of treatment isn't to control symptoms so much as to put the disease into remission, if at all possible. What do they mean by remission?
When the disease isn't active at all, doing a disease activity score will help you decide whether the patient's in remission. A 28-point score, counting how many joints are involved, measuring CRP, ESR, and also the patient's perception of how they feel.
So the aim is to get to the disease completely under control so that the patient is symptom-free, if at all possible. And medication for rheumatoid is likely to be started in secondary care, but it's helpful for us to be aware of what might be prescribed. Is it right that standard DMARDs, disease-modifying treatments, are still the first-line treatment, according to NICE?
Yes, absolutely. Methotrexate, sulfasalazine, or sometimes hydroxychloroquine is also used, yeah.
And then the cleverer, newer biological treatments are second line after that?
Yes, if treatment's failed or if this patients can't take the traditional treatment for some reason.
Do you ever prescribe bridging steroids until a patient's seen?
I haven't actually ever, but it's something I think I might consider if there was a delay in them being seen for some reason and if they were quite ill.
I have had a couple of occasions where I've phoned to speak to the rheumatologist who've suggested that we give often an IM dose of steroids to cover while they're being seen, which I don't think I've done it without advice, but it is something that's worth bearing in mind, as something you can be doing quickly. Do non-steroidal anti-inflammatories still have a role in rheumatoid arthritis?
Yes, certainly, if pain and stiffness isn't being controlled. But as usual, try and give the lowest possible dose for the shortest time, and often might need a PPI for cover as well.
Okay, yes, remembering kidney function and those sorts of concerns. One of the interesting things I thought in the module was around the multidisciplinary team in rheumatoid arthritis. Is that something you've had experience of, or who should we expect to be part of the MDT?
Well, according to NICE, physio, OT, podiatry, and they also mentioned psychologists, which I think certainly, you know, should be involved. But I'm not sure in the real world whether, unfortunately, they're able to be because of pressure on services.
Certainly where we are, we have psychology as part of the IAPT, the Improving Access to Psychological Therapist team that works specifically with people with physical disabilities, which may well include rheumatoid arthritis. But to the best of my knowledge, they're not embedded within the rheumatology teams themselves, as is being recommended here. But it makes sense that OT and physio will all be sort of an integral part of patient management. And indeed, the rheumatoid arthritis nurses or the rheumatology nurses, who can be the first port of call often for patients.
I think they are particularly useful for patients because in Wolverhampton there's a hotline where people can phone up and get advice. For instance, I had a patient who had shingles the other day and was on methotrexate, and whether she should stop her methotrexate. So we were able to phone them up for advice about that.
I've also found them very helpful as a GP to be able to phone up about mild blood abnormalities when you're monitoring some of the disease modifiers. So should we continue? Should we pause? What's the plan? It's useful to have a quick port of call to someone who knows a lot about their subject and can guide us and perhaps get further information from a pharmacist or the rheumatologist if needed.
Yes.
So monitoring, probably our biggest workload for these patients in primary care is monitoring the disease modifying agents. It should be part of a shared care arrangement. We wouldn't be suggesting anyone should be doing this without a shared care process in place. But how do you find it works in Wolverhampton?
Usually treatment is initiated in secondary care, and then once stable, they're transferred to primary care with a shared care agreement.
And that usually comes through as a very large document that you have to file in the patient's notes. But the critical thing is the frequency of blood monitoring and what to do if the results become abnormal. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so what systems do you think are helpful to enable us to prescribe safely and to monitor safely?
I think you need to have an audit set up, so you can audit regularly whether people are having their bloods. Some practices will remove all DMARDs from repeat prescribing so that they're only on acute, so that every time they're going to be prescribed, somebody can check up whether they've had their bloods regularly. And I know if you, say, use EMIS in trying to prescribe methotrexate, a big warning comes up and you can't prescribe it. It asks you to check the bloods have been done.
Yeah, I think that can be very helpful. I mean, the biggie with methotrexate is that it's a weekly dose, and I think that's one of the commonly most dangerous things where people have been taking it daily. That's always the biggest alert, isn't it? Within our practice, we now have a pharmacist who is taking on a lot of the DMARD monitoring because it's not large numbers of patients, but it is probably some of our highest risk prescribing. I also sometimes cheat and give patients a large stack of blood test forms and just scribble the month that they're supposed to have them done so that then they've got them, particularly for younger patients who are not at the doctors a lot, and it's just to make it as smooth as possible for them to have their next year's worth of blood tests on a regular basis so they can just pop in. But it's finding a system that works for that individual patient because it can be quite onerous, the monitoring as well as managing the disease, can't it?
Yes, and especially, as you say, a young person, if they've got to take time off work to have the bloods done.
Yes, email correspondence can also be helpful, and we've just started being able to use text messages a lot more with our patients, which is a huge step forward. So it can be quite helpful, certainly for younger patients, just to be able to send us a text saying your blood tests are due and your form's at reception. Hopefully we can make it a bit easier because it's always a complex area in day-to-day work that takes up a lot of time. As far as I'm aware, it's no longer part of QOF, but it's still good practice to offer an annual review to patients with rheumatoid arthritis. What do you want to cover in that appointment?
Yeah, NICE gives a whole list of things that it suggests, but a lot of this will be carried out in secondary care. For me, I think the most important thing is just sort of see how the patient is coping with their illness. It's taking a holistic approach to it. You know, checking they're not having problems with the drugs they're taking. Look for other comorbidities, which may be secondary care, which is just focusing on their rheumatoid, might be looking at. Just, you know, checking about hypertension, ischemic heart disease, osteoporosis, and also depression as well.
Looking at the whole situation for the patient. And the simple but effective things around home adaptations, if those are needed, or walking aids, and the sort of very broad look at a patient's function can be a good opportunity to do that. And one of the things I was wondering, I'm always looking for opportunities to reduce people's medication. Do NICE have anything to say about who can reduce their medication and how likely that is to succeed?
Well, they suggest if a patient's been stable for 18 months, then you could consider reducing their medication. Personally, I would be a bit reluctant to do this, but it might be something that if patients had been stable, you might talk about with them at their review for them to discuss with secondary care when they went.
It might be worth just prompting them to ask if they're interested in reducing their medicines, because it won't necessarily occur to secondary care either that we could perhaps step down some of these drugs. There is also advice in the guidance on when to refer for surgery. And I don't think I've ever referred someone with rheumatoid arthritis for surgery. Maybe this is all happening in secondary care, but is that something you've ever encountered?
Well, I've never referred anyone for surgery. I've had patients with rheumatoid arthritis who've had surgery, but they've all been referred from secondary care.
Yeah, to be aware of, from our point of view, that it is an option.
Yeah.
So was there anything in the guidance that surprised you or changed your practice?
The fact that having a positive rheumatoid factor doesn't necessarily mean that you've got rheumatoid arthritis or that you're going to develop it. I think quite a few people can have it without actually having the disease. And also the use of anti-CCP antibodies, which is a much more sensitive test than rheumatoid factor. And a patient who has positive anti-CCP antibodies is, even if they don't already have rheumatoid arthritis, is likely to develop it in the future. And it's quite a good guidance, apparently, to telling how severe the illness might become.
So that's really helpful. Anti-CCP antibodies are much more sensitive than rheumatoid factor, aren't they? And have a much higher predictive value. So yes, definitely one to include on your blood test form. So that's lovely. Thank you, Barbara, for your time. And thank you for listening to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the RCGP.